This week on the Design Review, we talk about making effective design decisions and what to do when you can't decide.
Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the Design Review. My name is Jonathan and with me is Chris. This week we're responding to an interesting fan mail that was sent to us. And if you want to also send us questions or podcast topics, feel free to do so. You can go to designreviewpodcast.com and send us a message through there, through Twitter, dr_podcast, or you can also go to anchor.fm/designreview. And we're always happy to answer specific questions that you're having, things you think we haven't covered yet, or whatever's on your mind, and do a podcast about it.
Yep. Keep it PG, please. Safe for work questions. So yeah, this week, actually, Lucas wrote us a while ago, and it's my fault that we're doing this so late, because last time we tried recording, I had technical issues, let's say.
Finally, it wasn't me. That's all I gotta say. After 100 episodes, it's finally you.
it's my fault we're so late with this show. But anyways, Lucas from Slovakia writes us by saying, "Hey guys, I would love for you to do an episode on how to make good design decisions, because this is something I'm struggling with every day. So what's my problem? I'm a UX designer and I often find myself in situations where I must decide what solution is right. Of course, I have some experience. I know best practices, look at data, etc. But what I mean is the little design decisions we all have to make. Imagine a situation where you come up with two solutions during brainstorming and you don't know which decision is the best because you are not a user. You do not know what he or she chooses. In addition, these solutions are so small that it does not make sense to organize user testing because you don't have time for that and you can't do it for every small decision. You have to make a decision fast. Do you have any tips on how I can improve as a designer in this decision making, or what's the right approach to them so that I don't look like someone who does not know what they're doing? Thank you in advance. Your podcast is the best. Keep going. Your fan, Lucas from Slovakia."
Hello, Lucas from Slovakia. Thanks for writing in.
Yeah. So right away, Lucas, there's a lot of things packed into your message there. And so let's break it down a little bit. And right away, you know, it bears saying that, you know, it's hard to give super concrete advice since we're not actually looking at, you know, any actual mock-ups or anything right now. So I apologize if we're not really addressing exactly the particular problem that you're referring to. But to paraphrase your scenario.
Yeah, here's what we hear you saying.
Yeah. This is what we think you're talking about. So you've come up with a couple of different ideas for something. You're not sure which way to go. You feel that, you know, this topic is too small to kind of warrant any further testing because, you know, you just sort of ruled it out in process. And then you're also concerned about timeliness and ensuring that you're making good decisions in a very short amount of time.
And these are all great things to like to be thinking about as a designer, especially as you look to like grow in your career. So huge hats off to you, Lucas, that like these are some of the things you're identifying in your own process that are slowing you down or are kind of causing you to spin a little bit, or maybe just the quality of your ideas, you know that they can be better. And so I think we all kind of come to that conclusion at some point in our design career where it's like, okay, I'm working on this, but like, how do I plug into this process that I know works much better? But then sometimes I can, sometimes I can't. And these big decisions all the teeny tiny ones in between, don't fit in the right places where we've learned about. Right. Like they don't fit in with that overall process that we have in our head. And it takes some rearranging, it takes some experience and like all these different situations. And I think what we're going to try and do today is download a lot of that.
Yeah.
That we've learned and hopefully that helps. And then some of that will still be at a head level. And as you apply it, you'll see like the small modifications that you need to make every time for yourself.
Yeah. So, from my perspective, you know, maybe to generalize a little bit, all of what you're saying, Lucas, really points at this one particular issue, which is that you're lacking a certain amount of information in order to move forward. Would you agree with that, John?
Yeah. It's like there's these decision points, and he wants to unblock it through research. He wants to unblock it through like knowing which design is best and whatnot. Yeah. And that's blocking him from moving forward. And so he doesn't know how to do that. Yeah. I think that's a great summary.
Yeah. And so, you know, notice I didn't say data, because it's not always, you know, spreadsheets and charts that are going to help you out. You know, sometimes it's just other kinds of information, other sources of things that you need to look for in order to help unblock you. A lot of times, like, I know when I get stuck, you know, a lot of the times the types of information that helps me is like stuff that can, you know, yield some insights or different kinds of like ideas that help me think about things in a different way. And the more of that I get in the beginning, the more effective my decision making becomes sort of later on down the road. And so luckily, you know, even though you might be missing some critical piece of information, luckily you do have some different options. And one of the things that I think right away that we should just sort of get out of the way is that, first of all, as a designer, all you really have to do is just sort of fit the spec or whatever requirements or the Jira ticket or whatever that is being given to you, and just sort of do whatever is being said. And
I mean, and that's like generally what's in our head, or like what's in other people's head. So like,
yeah.
Keyword is there's like superficially, like
yeah,
at that
like
level.
Superficially. Yeah. Yeah.
But if the thing is like, generally that's what we start doing too. When we start out in this career, is you look at the specs and you're like, oh, okay, this has been figured out. And now it's my job to like, you know, render this or work on this. And you'll find yourself at the same place as Lucas, where you're like tearing your hair out and being like, I don't know what to do next. I either feel lost, or I can't come up with the right ideas and what have you. And what you'll find is as you look back up at those requirements and things, you start to realize that, I actually need to influence back up the chain.
Yeah. There's more to it,
like,
often.
Yeah. I need to, so we'll talk about that.
Yeah.
But, that is absolutely one of the first places to look.
Yeah. So, you know, I definitely don't recommend just sort of following specs and stuff like that, because, yeah, like as you said, John, there's always more to it than just whatever somebody wrote down. But there's also like kind of no design police that comes and arrests you for doing that. Maybe there should be, but
I mean, I was thinking about it. It's like in some way, like that almost would be nice, right? It's like when you're kind of lost in the abyss of all these possibilities with your design, you almost want to know, like, when am I doing it right and when am I doing it wrong? But unfortunately, there is no like fully right or wrong, right? It's like there's like a multitude of answers and ways and context. And so you'll never have that pat on the back of like, hey, you got 100% A+. Even when the launch goes well, it's like, could it have gone better? You don't know.
And I also wanted to mention also quickly, you know, we'll get into this more later on, but I do want to say that I do think that it's a good idea to run usability tests, even though, you know, in this one particular instance, maybe it seems a little, sort of heavy handed, but, chances are there's probably a lot of other things that usability testing will reveal that will also help you in subsequent projects and things like that. But we'll talk about this more as we get into it. So anyways, decision making for designers. So, fundamentally, there's a lot of different types of decisions that you have to make as a designer. And they all have different levels of scope and different levels of impact. And again, because we're not looking at anything in particular, it's hard to tell what type of decision-making problem this is exactly. But we'll start with some basic things. So the first The lowest level, the most easiest thing to decide, is when you're working on something that only affects a single screen or a single instance of something, right? Like you're just changing one particular thing, or maybe you're just making like a single marketing landing page and it doesn't have to connect with really anything else that, you know, that's in the product, right? Decisions at this level, they tend to not cause too many problems because as long as you sort of follow like general usability and accessibility guidelines, you're really not going to create too many problems. And so you're more or less free to do whatever you like in a way. And you know, if you're having difficulty choosing between options, you just sort of pick something, you know, there's nothing really like, there's, you know, like I said, there's no design police that's going to tell you.
Yeah. You know, and sometimes that's a really good point too, is that like sometimes the answer is, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You know, and like we get into this job because we really care about the details, but when it's blocking you from making progress or, you know, working on other things or being like super unproductive, sometimes it's good to just, make a decision and move forward.
Yeah.
And say like, this might be a less, you know, a less optimal, decision, but I'm going to move forward with it because I need to keep moving forward. And at some point in the future, you may become super crystal clear which one of the right answer was and you can make the adjustment, or you live with, you know, the impact difference or what have you. So like sometimes the answer is you just need to pick and move on.
Yeah. You know, it's okay to just, you know, use your best judgment and just pick something. You know, if you have, you know, already an existing style guide or some kind of design system, you can, you know, borrow heavily from whatever stuff is in there. Usually this type of thing is also pretty easily reviewed, right? So you can just run it by some people or talk to your manager, just show some options to people and get some feedback.
Right? Yes, you don't have to have all the answers. You don't need to be a design genius that comes up with a brand new UI pattern every project, right? You don't need to be this design hero syndrome, right? Where you feel like you absolutely have to, you know, be the most impactful person on the project and blow everybody's minds.
Yeah.
Get that out of your head. Like you are, you know, you can follow best practices, your own patterns. And sometimes it's just your work is to put it all together into a UI that makes sense. And that's super valuable. And then you also don't have to nail it the first version. You can like put it all together. Okay. Here's a version and shop that around and get feedback and then iterate on that a bunch more. Like, I think that's one of the most common cruxes that I see designers, falling, like the traps that designers fall into is they feel like they have to always, you know, have the right answer. So like, I see like, you know, sometimes in like critiques and things like that, where we're coming for feedback from the group and they have this like polished presentation and polished designs and like, no, come earlier and come with raw stuff. Like, it's okay. This feedback is all just to make the ideas better. It's not about your work or my work. It's just getting the work done and making it really great.
Yeah. And if it's still really a problem where it's like, okay, you're stuck and you really can't decide between one or the other, just pick one. And then, you know, you can work with engineers so that they build it in such a way that, you know, maybe it'll be easier to update so that you can come back to it later and just like make whatever updates, you know, that need to be made, right? It's as simple as that. Okay. So that's kind of like the like really basic level of decision making, right? And up a level from that is, you know, beyond an individual screen is looking at things like screen flows and interaction flows and various like multi-step processes that sometimes we have to create, right? And this is stuff like signup flows or, like multi-step tasks in an application or like checkout funnels or things of that nature. And so whenever you're designing for this type of situation, it's really about designing for understanding and not necessarily efficiency. You know, it's more important basically to make sure that the user understands what's happening and what's coming next in any type of like sort of multi-step process.
And oftentimes I'll do these first, like make sure I'm on the same page with, you know, the PMs or whoever is working on, you know, putting these requirements together. and saying like, hey, is this what we're planning to do? Does this make sense? And oh my gosh, the amount of times that the whole group has not thought about these flows is very, very, very high. And so I think this is one of the big places designers can contribute is visualizing what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Whether that's through user flows or through other means, like can be a really big value add to your team and is absolutely going to de-risk or de-stress all that future work.
Yeah.
Where you find yourself trying to figure out, like you're trying to make a screen work and you're putting together all these like, you know, iterations and you're like, it's just not working. And then you realize that the flow just doesn't make sense. And that's why, you know, like you trying to force this user action to happen. You're struggling with that is because it doesn't make sense. Like maybe, you know, this flow should be different. Maybe it should be multiple steps.
Yeah.
Maybe, you know, the base requirements need to change. Like even at the flow level that can be uncovered.
Yeah. Try to imagine that each step in the flow fulfills a single important function, right? And sometimes that means making a page longer by combining different things together. And sometimes that means adding additional steps in the process, by separating things, that don't make sense to go together. And it just sort of all depends on, what you're doing. You always, always, always want to map out your flows, right? So like if you're trying to like, if you're working with sort of, an existing thing and trying to optimize it, map it out first, right? How many steps are there? What are these UIs, you know, what do they involve? What are the things that people are having to do? If you're starting from scratch, you know, you can start your visualization of it just by mapping it out and what sort of things should somebody be providing at various different, you know, screen states, for example.
Yeah.
Designers often struggle with this because they're trying to guess at what would convert at a higher rate. And you're often being told many different things that sound truthful, you know. So for example, like, in my experience, a lot of marketers tend to think that fewer steps automatically is always better. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And sometimes that's true, but not if the cost is the user is confused, right?
Yeah, like one great example of that is I worked on an app that calculated sales tax for small businesses, and it's very complex. And the risk of getting for the user of getting that wrong is like, you know, huge tax penalties, even potentially jail time.
Right.
So in our user testing, we confirmed that people take this very seriously. So, you know, everyone kept pushing for like, oh, it should be on a single screen and da 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 da. Like, sign up should be super fast. Like, no, that's not what they want. They want it to be very clear, crystal clear on like what's going on, so that they have 100% accuracy. And actually, accuracy is not. So we had to break things up into multiple steps. And every single review that we went up to, people kept saying like, does it need to be so many steps?
Yeah.
And every time in user testing, it came up that people liked it being more steps and had a higher rate of completion and more confidence. So, 100% plus one on that. It's like, and you hear this a lot of times, like, because like it might have been true at the beginning of their career, like, especially from very experienced people. It's like, the CTA always needs to be, you know, above the fold or whatever, you know, you hear something like that. And it sounds like Bible truth coming from them, or it sounds like something that has been decreed and is like, and everybody's like, yes, yes. Everybody in the meeting is like, yeah, of course, we all know it. Because they've heard this like little clip being like played over and over again. And it has to be over the fold. But actually one of the great, advantages you have as a newer designer, especially, is that you don't know those things yet. And a lot of those things have changed or are wrong now. Yeah. So like keep testing those things out and following your gut a little bit and saying, you know, like that doesn't really make sense. Cause like the way I, you know, see people behaving is like this. And that means that this would happen. And really, following that and look, you know, one, looking that up and seeing like, are there examples of that, in, you know, apps that have done a lot of, you probably have done a lot of R&D or have like very talented people working on them. Oh, okay. Maybe then we don't need to do it that way. So definitely test those things out.
Yeah, totally. And if you're still, you know, really having difficulty deciding in a situation like this, in my experience, it is always, always easier to start with a flow that is much longer than what people think it ought to be and then try to shorten it later if need be. right?
Mm, that's a great point.
Because it's way harder to make a take a short, like condensed, hyper-focused funnel and then expand it, you know, because unless you're conducting all the usability tests like as you did, right, the metrics that you're going to collect will never point at the sort of gaps in understanding that the user's facing. And so a better way to deal with it is just to establish your baseline using a longer interaction funnel, right? And then look at where, you know, things are problematic and then maybe decide later to like shorten it or condense it. But don't shorten it, you know, just because somebody said, hey, this should be, you know, 3 steps instead of 5, right? Well, what,
yeah, and that's a great way to approach a lot of creative things, like whether you're designing the screen itself, the flow, whether you're writing an essay. I mean, it's like get all the things down there, you know, in long form. It doesn't matter. Just getting all the pieces on the board and then looking at the ways you can like condense and, you know, move things around. Because if you try and do that, you're just going to be stuck. You're going to hit a lot of creative blocks that way.
Yeah. And then, you know, or worse, like, you know, just make a lot of bad decisions and you don't know why, you know, things aren't working out the way, you know, you thought they were, because, you know, we did what the guy said, you know, the thing is above the fold and this and that, but it's still not working. Right. So,
where it's like, hey, on my device, it's above the fold. Yeah. On your device. Oh, wait, there's multiple devices here.
Yeah, exactly. So, okay. So that's flow. So beyond flows, now we're getting into really, really crazy territory where we're talking about whole systems now. And effectively, this is like the interconnection of various different flows and screens across an entire product. And this would be things like information architecture or various topics and domains or whole functions or even whole products. Now, when you're designing whole systems, this actually gets very, very tricky and very complicated, and it requires a lot of input from various different sources in order to provide the right sort of outcome for the user. And if you're designing systems, you're often looking at whole task flows in their entirety, right? And making sure that the user can, you know, achieve some significant objective, right? Like you mentioned with the sales tax thing, right? Like the most important thing that they can do is make sure that they enter the sales tax stuff correctly, right?
Yeah.
And how do you do that? Well, you look at this, you know, this one in this case, it was like building out an entire flow so that it communicates all the different things in the right way. And, you know, the danger with systems level thinking stuff is that, any problem that arises can have a really serious effect down the road. So imagine if you had sort of taken the advice and just like condensed your sales tax funnel into like 2 or 3 steps, right? You know, the maybe you would have like fit the requirements, but then, you know, people are out there getting all these like penalties and like jail time and all this kind of stuff. And it's, you know, it would be directly as a result of that decision making, right? And so, yeah, like, that's one of the big problems when making bad decisions, basically with systems level problems. You know, another example is like, you know, sometimes it's like just bad information architecture, right? That affects a lot of different parts of a system. And so trying to change that architecture, you know, it often requires a lot of review and buy-in in order to get it done. But as soon as you address those things, you know, it can fix a lot of other things down the road, right? That it affects. In my experience, a lot of design problems that I see or have worked on really are companies that have systems level problems, but they're really just trying to resolve it at a much lower level, right? With a flow or a particular screen, instead of really trying to address the actual problem. And, I don't know how many times I've gone through this exercise with different companies where it's like, yeah, we can, you know, it's like, yeah, I can change this screen for you, you know, or we can improve this one form. But the real work is like really moving this form in a different part of the application, or, you know, like, breaking out this particular flow in a way that makes sense so that, you know, as they fill out this information, you know, it connects back with other things that they've input into the system, you know, and those are the really challenging, types of problems that you often come up with, come up against rather as a designer. And just like with flows, you know, always map out systems, right? If you're mapping out a particular flow, it's even more important to map out how that flow interconnects with various other parts of the system, right? Because you can sometimes just spot problems just by doing a map and like just seeing where things interconnect or don't connect.
It's such a great way to make the rest of your decisions so much easier, is like understanding the flow and then understanding kind of the, all the pieces, like, of the problem and the screen itself. So like, you know, like we talk about information architecture, it's the information piece first and then the architecture piece second, right? It's like, okay, what are all the things that are happening? Like, what are all the elements on this page? What are all the, you know, what's all the data that's being, you know, used on this page and displayed and, you know, intaked and like just getting all those Lego pieces out on the table. And then once you have that, you know, then doing some architecture and this is literally all happening. You can not in Figma, I mean, or the Figma text tool or like whatever your design tool is, like just the text, just in text.
Yeah.
Like literally you can do this in a Word doc and just like typing that all out and then coming up with like, what is the overall like group of all these things. It's like essentially taking out the entire idea of the screen and typing it up.
Yeah.
Well, I will do wonders in helping you understand like what's actually going on in this screen and where do things belong?
Yeah.
And how much of those like of those elements need to be the focus and how much of those things can really be secondary or tertiary items. Because you'll quickly get into like this thing you're designing where you'll go in a loop of like, this is important. No, wait, this is important. No, this is important. And your design just always feels wrong. And then once you have the logic of the page all sorted out in your head and the architecture all sorted out in your head, it's almost become self-explanatory.
Yeah. Yeah, totally agree. So beyond that, so we've talked so far about some very kind of, what do we call this? I don't know what the word is, but it's like, these are all like very concrete sorts of things that you can do, but there's other things to consider as part of this like sort of knowledge gap, right? That will help with decision making. And the first thing I want to talk about with regards to that is who is it for, right? So I know we talked a lot about like how to approach, you know, screens and things, but one of the fundamental things to just ask right off the bat is like, who is it even for? Right. Sometimes, a company will know this information. And sometimes, you know, it's part of your job to also help figure that out.
It's like, what makes a great gift? Like, you would first have to know who the person is, right?
Yeah.
There's no like universal great gift. It becomes
cash
because you. I mean, it's not, right? I mean, like, it can be used for everything, but at the same time, it's not like, oh, I feel touched.
Oh, definitely.
If I got my wife cash for her birthday or something, like, you know.
Yeah, here's 10 bucks.
It wouldn't go over as well as, like, something that was very thoughtful, like, I know her. And, you know, it's the same with users. Like, there are these universal cash gift card things, for sure, right? Like, those are the maybe the best practices and things like that.
Yeah.
And then there's the thoughtful gifts where it's like the more you really understand like what their goals are, and what the different use cases they have are, the jobs to be done, then you can really take that cash and turn it into a great gift.
Yeah.
That really lands really, really well. And so that's why it's so important to understand your users, because you also might, you know, run into the fact that like, maybe some people are offended by cash in some cultures, right? Like,
yeah, that's true.
The user equivalent is that, like, you know, sometimes you'll run into issues where like users aren't responding the way that you would have expected, and it's because they have a totally different understanding of what you're presenting them. So, the more you know about your users, the easier it becomes to make those small decisions and those big decisions in the design and in the requirements, because you just check it against some basic knowledge around like what are they trying to accomplish? What is most important to them, et cetera. And again, it becomes almost self-explanatory.
Yeah.
But it's a mystery if you're just guessing, right?
Yeah.
If you're just guessing, it's like a mystery. Like I one of the things that always has stuck with me is I saw this really interesting GIF of like what a heliocentric observation of the heavens would look like.
Yeah.
Meaning helio, meaning like the sun. Because like I mean the Earth. Like so like sorry, there's an Earth-centric like measurement of the universe of the sorry the you know like the movements of all the planets,
the solar system.
So like yeah, the solar system.
Yeah.
So like you know for a long time they thought the Earth was the center, right?
Right.
And actually, you know, like you could explain the movements based off of that, like how the sun would move and the moon would move in relation to each other, given that the Earth is static. And it was really interesting because it's like so chaotic. It's so complex. It's so crazy. But once you find the truth of the matter that actually the sun is and everything just kind of circles around it and the moons just circle around those.
Yeah.
It just becomes so simple. Right. And that's always stuck with me in the fact that like a lot of times when we see a really complex system is because we don't understand it correctly.
Right.
And so the more you understand it correctly, the more it just becomes very simple and straightforward.
Yeah. One of the horror stories that I often bring up in, I've talked about this on this show a lot. But usually in this situation, one of the things that, that I've experienced is one time I asked a PM who's a customer? Who is it for? And their answer was anyone willing to pay for it, which is like, okay. yeah, I get that. Like, but that, you know, that's actually a what, not a who. and so what we're talking about basically is like, make sure that you understand who the customer is, right? And often we use personas for this. And so you can, you know, if you're using personas, make sure that they're based off of interviews rather than surveys. Because when you conduct an interview, you can actually ask meaningful questions and follow up on anything interesting that they might have said during the conversation.
And also catch mistakes with the way that you're asking the questions or the phrasing or their interpretation. That's always going to be missing when you do a big survey is like in a risk of doing surveys is like you're not there to interpret.
Yeah.
So like a lot of times, you know, you put together a great, research, like template or of questions and a script. That's the thing I was looking for. So like, you know, like you put together a research script and then during the interview, you realize that people are interpreting it this way or this specific person interpreted it that way. And when you send it out blindly, you don't get that. So like, that's another really big bonus that qualitative interviews have over, surveys.
Yeah. And with an interview that's qualitative, you don't even need, you know, hundreds or thousands of people. You really only need like 8 to 10 folks, you know, at the most, just to participate and have conversations around what are kind of their needs and their chief concerns. And, all you have to do is document everything and sort of share that with the company. And usually every time, you know, that I've done it, you know, it's like people are like, yeah, we should be doing way more of this, like way more often.
Always, yeah. You know. And then the next project, they totally forget.
Yeah, they totally forget about it.
Because it's hard, like, especially if it's not something that you do often.
Yeah.
You really need to get into the rigor of understanding your requirements and immediately kicking off research because it has a lead time to it where you have to, like, put together the script. You have to recruit users. And even if you're using a vendor, it takes generally a really fast amount, like 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And generally more like 3 to 4 weeks to get it to happen. Not that it's like, you know, taking 24 hours a day for that many weeks. It's just, you know, the time it takes for people to respond back and all, you know, find a time that works for them and all that kind of stuff. So generally you're not going to get it back like immediately unless you have like ongoing rolling research, which generally happens at larger companies. but it's so critical. So making sure that that's part of the project planning is very important.
Yeah. And, you know, ideally you could do this alongside with, you know, the work that the product managers are doing. And, you know, a lot of your findings can actually contribute to requirements and things that they'll be preparing. It's really important to sort of cultivate some knowledge around who is the customer and what is it that they actually need. And so that leads me to sort of the next topic, which is what is the problem that they're experiencing, right? What is the problem that you're being asked to think about? Now, this is something that should be very clearly articulated by product management. So, you know, if they're not doing that, then, you know, that's a place to start as a designer. And something I want to mention as a sort of a side note, something that I kind of take away from a lot of my mentor sessions is that, I get the sense from some designers, that they believe that product managers sort of are infallible in some way. And this is just not the case, right? People are human. People make mistakes. Sometimes they get things wrong. And it is part of your job as a designer to kind of ask questions and probe on things and try to find out more, you know, for anything that's unclear. You know, we talked about this in the beginning, right? Where we said, you know, superficially, all you have to do is just follow what somebody wrote and like do it as they said. But, realistically, like your job is really to ask questions and think critically about what they're saying so that, you know, you get exactly to the right level of sort of problem that exists out there. Now, if nobody in the company, you know, can articulate what the problem is, then you're really in a lot of trouble. Because, you know, you can sort of get away with making assumptions about who the customer is, but, you know, not really, but you can sort of do it. But without a clear understanding of what the problem is and, you know, what needs to be addressed, you're just going to have a really hard time doing anything, and making decisions. And so, when I'm talking about a problem also, I am not talking about, you know, a company needing to generate another $10 million in revenue. The problem is, right, what is the problem that the customer is experiencing, right? Make sure, and this is why, you know, this is why all this customer research stuff is really important, is because it's about understanding what they need you to do as an organization.
And I mean, that kind of research doesn't need to be something you do every single time.
Right.
But if you don't, you haven't done it on, you know, fairly recently, like within the last year or so, that, you know, you have research to stand on, like it's really well understood who our users are, what their, you know, mindset is, what their jobs to be done are, like all those kinds of things, then do that research. And then you can use that for many projects. Like you don't need to be doing that kind of research for every single, you know, small project that is part, you know, part of the, you know, feature set or something. But like, as you add new features, though, like, you know, like let's say you have a accounting product, and you know you're going from like, you know, taking payments from the customers and things like that to also doing the sales tax now or something. That's like a whole new aspect that you haven't explored, so you would want to do some more research for that. But let's say you're just making, you know, it easier to refund a user what they paid, like that's still in the wheelhouse of what you have done already, that's well understood.
Yeah.
So what I'm trying to say is that there's going to be a portion where you don't need to do that for every single project, but look out for the ones that kind of change or are brand new areas that aren't well understood, and then do the research for those.
Yeah, it's important, you know, make sure you're setting aside enough time to sort of do that. In addition also to just identifying what the problem is, it's important to have some assessment of what type of problem it is, so that you can sort of address it sort of in the right way. As we talked about, not all of the problems you're going to solve are equal, right? They all have different sort of context to them. So there's kind of a different type of response that you have to come up with. One of the big things that I've seen often is a lot of clients or companies, they sometimes mismatch problem types to solution types, right? Meaning that they have a particular type of problem, but they're only addressing it in a particular type of way, or vice versa, right? They have a much, smaller problem and a much bigger type of solution. This is due to any number of things, right? Sometimes, you know, companies run out of time to sort of address something in the right way, or, sometimes it's just generally like the company itself is not aligned. Like I've definitely seen it where, you know, two managers disagreed with each other, you know, 5 years ago, and now they hate each other and they don't want to work well together. but for this project, it's causing a lot of issues because, you know, they just, these two guys like disagreed one time. or, you know, there's like a lack of priority or just bad processes or other kinds of misinformation, right? We talked a little bit about like how having the wrong idea of the customer can be a problem, or could be all of these all at once, you know, all of this stuff. It creates a kind of debt. It creates product debt. And, you know, this could be either like technical debt, like, you know, the engineers having to overbuild certain things, or maybe they don't sort of build things in the right way. Sometimes it's also just design debt or UX debt because, you know, the design doesn't really, you know, solve the right problem. The reason why this is really problematic is because, you always end up sort of behind, right? You always end up behind schedule for some reason, and you either have to play catch up or just limit the sort of potential for this, project to succeed because you have to compromise as a result of the debt that exists. And, usually what it is like, you know, you're just constantly running fire drills. And, you know, I remember being in that situation before where, you know, the real problems weren't being addressed, but, you know, you have this immediate need to like do all this other stuff. And so you're just constantly in the state of panic, you know, constantly shipping things to try and address, you know, what is sort of what seems most important at the time, when really there's all this other stuff that's just building up and building up. And that's really just a sign of just the mismatch between the problem and the solution, and then the product debt sort of growing.
Yeah, I'm really not having that like holistic vision of what the product is supposed to do for the user. Like, should be coming from the CEO and like the leaders of the company. It's really hard to do that from the bottom up, but, and as a designer, you know, we try to create these holistic experiences. So at least like on your own level, thinking about, you know, how this design you're working on connects with other parts of the flows that it's a part of, the design systems that it's a part of, and all these other things, like you can start to create some consistency there. And then also like start to use that research to help align the rest of the team. Like we talked about earlier in the show, you know, you get these requirements and they, at the beginning, they feel like, oh, wow, this is someone's done like all the research here, or sometimes not.
Yeah.
Where it's like, hey, make the conversion rates go up. And like, that's all the, you know, so you really have to start to critique and understand like what's missing there, what needs to be there. And if the holistic vision is not there, you need to push and ask for that. You don't need to have all the answers. You might, because you're very smart.
Yeah.
But, you don't need to have all answers. You can ask the questions. You can identify to the team what's missing and say, hey, you know, it looks like this, you know, we're looking at the requirements, but I still don't understand how we're going to measure success here. Like, I really don't understand, you know, it says the goal is this, but I don't understand how, you know, adding this feature is going to help that. So be a critique what's always coming into your deck, into your desk, and make sure that it makes sense to you 100%. Because one, the ideas in general for your team will get better. And two, it's very difficult to design a great experience around something that doesn't make sense. It doesn't sit with you well, because that's a kind of our designer's job. It's like, we have to take this concept and make it like a legit reality, like exactly what is the UI going to look like for the user and what is the experience as they go step to step going to look like. So it's very easy for like a PM or whoever's putting together the requirements to miss a lot because they're not the ones that are going to have, they're not actually putting it together in a very real way.
Yeah.
They're more at the concept level. So that's why like I think designers are in a really good position to identify those gaps is because we're constantly having to look at that and then
understand
what that's actually going to be and how it's actually going to be, how it's actually going to be used by the users and how well it's going to be received. So critique that, just like engineers should be critiquing your work. I think the best engineers I've ever worked with are the ones who give me feedback to say like, this design doesn't look consistent with this. I'm like, oh shoot, you're right. Or like, you know, why would the user want to click this when they would want to click that? You know, like it, just like the, any kind of feedback they give, whether it's in their domain or not, is helpful. You know, even if they're totally wrong, it creates like a good conversation where we get to educate them. But a lot of the best engineers that I've ever worked with are the ones that give me design feedback. And so the same would be said for anyone else you work with. It doesn't matter if it's legal or marketing or PMs. They want you to critique their work. And at the worst, at the absolute worst, it'll help you understand it better and help you implement whatever part you have to collaborate with them on.
Yeah.
So I highly recommend, you know, pushing back and understanding, asking the right questions and potentially getting those things changed, but understanding it nonetheless.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, some of the best PMs that I've ever worked with, they treated their documents as more of a dialogue rather than, you know, trying to be like the absolute be all end all to everything. And
same for design too. Like you shouldn't treat your designs like that either. Like it should be this malleable thing that the entire team can get their hands on because you want it to just be the best it possibly can. It's your job to facilitate the answers being found, not to always have the answers, you know, being this lone ranger.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes you have the answers, but you know, the point is like, you know, make sure you're asking these questions, you know, make sure you ask why, right? Like, why is this a problem? Why is this, you know, not already addressed? You know, why is this important to solve? Things of that nature, right? Because, through asking those types of questions, you'll get the kinds of answers that, will help you understand how to solve a particular problem and at what level, you need to sort of address it. Because this type of problem definition stuff, it really affects scope and scale, right? So, when we talk about debt, you know, a lot of time, if you understand the problem, then you'll be able to appropriately define a solution that works for the right level. Okay. So what else? So beyond that, there's other kinds of stuff you could use to help with, decision making. And, you know, let's say hypothetically that, you know, you absolutely don't have any time to do anything other than just like, you know, sort of some basic research and then just make some stuff. So what could you be doing? So the first thing would be to look at, you know, prior art and do some competitive analysis, right? So what are the existing products that the customer might be using in order to get things done? How did previous versions of the software you're working on sort of address this problem? If it's completely brand new, obviously looking at competing products is something to look for.
Or sometimes even parallel products. They might not do exactly what your company does, but they do something similar. Like, you know, maybe you have like a marketplace where, you know, there's a third party marketplace on your site or something.
Yeah.
You can look at like Amazon. You could look at like just
other marketplace products.
Sell stuff or like it doesn't have to be a direct competitor.
Yeah. Because chances are, you know, the customer might be looking at these sorts of things as well. Right. They might be familiar with some of them. So yeah, looking at these different things can be very helpful. Another thing you can look at is just other like past metrics and past data. Like how did this feature perform in the past? Do you have any sort of data that shows how well or how poorly something performed? And even if it's not exactly the same, you know, sometimes like just looking at, sort of adjacent examples that are sort of similar, they can provide at least some amount of insight on, maybe not what to do, but like what not to do.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is all sort of design research that hopefully you've already done sort of early on. But, you know, even if not, it's still good to kind of do it. If it's, you know, something you don't have at hand, you know, as a freelancer, this is stuff that I ask clients, about all the time is like, you know, can you provide me, with some examples of competitors or similar competing products? Because, it's important, first of all, just to get an understanding of how other people are trying to solve the same types of problems. And two, especially if you're freelancing, it's like you want to kind of know whether or not the client you're working with knows the industry that they're in, right? Because if they don't understand who their competitors are, that's a real serious problem.
Yeah. I mean, and also like these companies have like been around, right? Like they've done something and like going from zero to one, there's going to be so many unknown unknowns about whatever your feature you're adding or, you know, however you're approaching that design. So just by doing a competitive analysis, like you're not going to go and like copy them. Like I think we've all been burned a little bit by, you know, people we've worked with that are like, oh, we just need to copy eBay or whatever. Yeah. And, and so we have a bad taste in our mouth of like looking at competitors, but no, it's so important to just see the lay of the land, see the things that you're missing, see how they approach things, curate and find the best version of all of these put together that makes sense for your user and your product and all that. Yeah. But just ignoring them is not a good idea.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of times, like I'll look at a competitor and go, wow, this looks really, really complicated. You know,
yeah.
And isn't there,
don't want to do that.
Yeah. Like, isn't there a way we could just sort of simplify this for people, you know? And then that becomes sort of like the design goal, you know, and you work towards kind of simplifying things that your competitors are doing very poorly. But yeah.
And I mean, if you are in a very competitive environment with other companies, like it's important to look at them for the reason that you want to be differentiated in the market.
So right,
you need to say like, hey, this is how they did it. How can we do this in a differentiated way that we can attract users? So like it's sometimes it's even like, yeah, like looking at what do we avoid? How do we avoid looking too similar to our competition?
Just sort of doing some cursory design research is really helpful for helping with later decisions. And hopefully you have done that in your projects, Lucas. Okay, so the last thing that I want to address is your general concern about timeliness. And, you know, there's quite a lot of things that affect speed and timeliness. And a lot of product orgs today are just getting used to working off of assumptions rather than like building in knowledge, you know, and like designing processes that help like fuel this engine with knowledge.
Yeah. They're into addition versus multiplication.
Yeah.
That's what it feels like. It's like, we're just like looking at like, how do we, you know, focus on like the quick and easy plus ones plus tens versus the times two. It's like, oh, well, 2 times 2 is 4. 10 is more. It's like, no. But you get another times two and then another times two. And like, finding those multiplicative type of opportunities or process improvements and things like that are so important. But oftentimes people are too focused on like that little jump iteration that's much bigger because, you know, it's immediate.
Yeah. And the odd thing that happens sometimes with this stuff is that, it actually can make things take longer despite shipping things really quickly. And why is that? Well, it's because iterations are only effective as the knowledge that produces them, right? So if you're working off of incomplete knowledge, of course, your iterations are only going to do so much, right? And that's this additive sort of thing versus multiplicative. Now, of course, biasing towards speed is really important, right? You have to, you know, especially today, everything is like hyper, you know, like in hyperspeed. But in my experience, speed is something you build up towards based on a lot of the good habits and training and stuff that you build in to your process rather than just working fast for the sake of being fast. And literally, like, every world-class athlete that you see out there will tell you that their competitions are actually won in the gym, right? It's not won out on the field. It's won by their training, meaning that you have to build very good foundations in order to move quickly, because it's all that preparation and training that you're doing. That's the part that matters when you get out there and start trying to compete. And so what I was talking about earlier with regards to usability testing, of course, moving quickly and sort of not slowing things down to like do some research, like that obviously makes a lot of sense. But, it's always more work to sort of get a usability testing discipline started, but it provides so much more, you know, than just that one test session, right? I remember, for example, one of the jobs that I worked, I had to sort of ship new stuff on a weekly basis, right? Every week we're coming up with new things to sort of produce and put out there. And it was hard. It was really, really difficult to do that because it was like, it just felt like a super grinder of a, of a job where you're just like cranking out stuff every week. The one thing that was sort of nice about it was like the work was kind of focused in a certain way, so that we weren't like, it sort of felt like doing usability testing wasn't really that helpful. And so what ended up happening was it just kind of bought us time because we were shipping lots of stuff. You know, it looked really nice to managers that they were seeing stuff go out every week. And you know, we looked busy because we were always like shipping stuff. But ultimately I think nothing positive actually happened, right? Like in the big picture, right? Like we were shipping a lot of stuff and things were happening, but it wasn't like we were materially making like significant improvements, right? And this was that like plus one thing, right? Where like, yeah, we may have incrementally added a little bit here and a little bit there, but it really wasn't like amounting to a whole lot. Now the weird thing is,
it's like,
no, go ahead.
No, I mean, it's just a cute, it always reminds me of like, you know, spinning wheels on the mud and not going anywhere, but like going, you know, hard as you can, like, and stressing the engine and all the parts, and but you're just going nowhere. Or like the fact that, like, you know, you can be in a race car going faster than any other car on the street, but you're going in the wrong direction. It does not matter,
yeah,
right?
Doesn't matter,
you you're just getting further faster.
Yeah.
So like, that always comes to mind when I think about that, like how important all that is because it helps align you on where you're going. And like that's more important than anything. Cause like, you know, especially when you're going on a long journey, a like 1% difference in your direction, you know, if you're going from like one side of the United States to the other will totally get you in like so far from your end goal, you know?
Yeah.
And that's just like a 1%. So that's why it's so important to have those like UXR, because it's like these constant checks around, okay, well, like, are we going in the right place? Are we going in the right place? Are we going in the right place? And that's going to help you end up where you need to go which is much more important than just keep revving in the wrong direction.
Yeah, totally.
But it's one of those things where like in the beginning, it just feels like a 1% difference. What's the you know, who cares?
Yeah.
And it multiplies over time.
Yeah. And that's the weird thing about it, right? Is that if you had already started doing usability testing, you wouldn't have this question right now, more than likely, right? Because these little problems end up being sort of solved by the fact that you've already got the research to answer the question. And this is one of the reasons why design teams often sort of shy away from doing research, because, you know, it sometimes takes a lot of effort just to get it started, right? To recover from this big gap of like this lack of research that hasn't happened in, you know, the past like 3 years, right? Because we were always shipping something. And so we haven't done the research, but, you know, we're always shipping something. So, it always feels like it's a lot of work just to get the research started. But The thing is if you had already started it, you would already have the answers you need. And that's one of the things, right? And so it's one of those weird things where like the best time to have started testing was yesterday. The second best time,
the next best time is today.
And then the worst time is just to wait whenever you could fit it in, because it's just, you know, it's never going to be fit in if you don't sort of proactively, you know, schedule it and plan it and work with people to do it. It's really important to do this type of work, even though you might feel like, hey, it's too much effort, or, you know, I'm not sure what the outcome is, and so maybe we shouldn't do it. Chances are it's stuff that is going to obviously help you, and it probably provide a lot of answers that are much longer lasting, right, for a lot of different types of scenarios. I think once you start doing it, the speed and quickness at which you make decisions actually improves rather than suffers. But it's just because you're missing that information now that it's hard to make the sorts of decisions that can be really super effective. So yeah, that's actually about all I have on Lucas's email.
Awesome.
Do you have any other maybe closing comments?
Yeah, I think that overall, like what you're seeing here is like, I think some of our big ideas boil down to is just that you really need to understand deeply the fundamentals of your product, like understanding what is the problem of the product in general, you know, that we're solving. What is the problem of this particular feature that we're solving, you know, and then what are the different pieces and all that kind of stuff. So like the more you like understand it is what it is you're doing before actually jumping into it, is going to help make that a much easier time, where like all those little decisions that just make you feel so lost, or I'm like, okay, well, you know, this layout or this layout, like, I don't know, like what's the difference? Who cares?
Yeah.
is going to become so obvious once you've understood like what's going on. So it really comes down to like every time you feel that way, like taking the time to understand everything upstream is going to make the next step feel very obvious.
Yeah, totally.
And like, you know, we talk about like research and all that, but that's really something that like kind of comes from, you know, up higher up, right? Like in the process of understanding what it is you're doing. And once you've done that, like it just feels so much easier.
Yeah. So that's it. Hopefully we helped answer your questions, Lucas. If not, feel free to send us another message saying that we didn't answer your question. Yeah. but that's kind of all we have for today. So thanks for listening to that. If you have a question out there and you want us to answer it as well, as we mentioned at the beginning of the show, you can visit designreviewpodcast.com. You can ask us there. You can also find us on Twitter. To ask us there at @dr_podcast. That's the show. I am Machine Human, and John is.
I'm Design UX UI. Leave us a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast, and allows you to leave a review.
Yeah.
this really helps us out a lot, both in being encouraged to make the show, but also in other people finding it. So. Take some time today if you can. Leave us a review. We'd be greatly obliged. And also, if you're looking for more one-on-one advice and you don't want a whole podcast done about it, it's going to be a little more personal. The officehoursproject.com that Chris puts together is a great, 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 great tool for that.
Thanks. Lastly, also, we should mention anchor.fm/designreview. So if you want to either leave us a little donation to the show.
Well, something. We were just talking about buying some better mics. So curious if people like the quality of the show, or they're wondering about that, because we definitely think about those things, but you might not.
You can leave us a donation there, or leave us a message with your question or whatever. So there's a lot of different ways for you to get in touch with us to get some advice on whatever sorts of issues might be plaguing you. Thanks again for taking the time to listen. Hopefully this was insightful for you. And yeah, we'll be back again in a couple weeks with another new episode of Design Review.
Woohoo! Hey. Thanks, everyone.
Bye.
Talk to you soon. Bye. 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 How do you say bye in Cantonese?
Joikin.
Nice. Chris is learning how to speak.
I'm learning basic stuff. Yes. Joikin.
Look at that.
Yes. Or in Mandarin, it's Zaijian.
Nice. Wait, so are you learning both?
I learned Mandarin a long time ago.
Oh, okay. Nice.